Very good. Well, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome to everyone, and a very special welcome to our two guests, Timothy Quill and Lydia Dugdale. So my name is Victor Sines. I'm a lecturer at the Rice University Philosophy Department and executive director of the Houston Institute. So let me tell you a little bit about Houston Institute before we jump in to our discussion for tonight. So Houston Institute is an academic nonprofit whose mission is to help the people of Rice University think deeply about the best way to live through the study of the humanities, especially philosophy and literature. We do this by sponsoring programming for undergraduates and graduate students, such as targeted reading groups, lecture, one-on-one intellectual mentorship, four-credit courses, and the like. We also have larger events like this, where we invite those beyond the hedges, which is the Rice term for people off campus, to join us in our inquiries. So our aim is to build a robust intellectual community centered on asking what it means to live a good life. So to give you some examples, so this semester we've just finished, appropriately enough, a 5-week reading group on death. As the pandemic was hitting, we sponsored a seminar on solitude and loneliness. And we're currently sponsoring a 3-credit course in the philosophy department on the philosophy of religion. We'll soon be starting a 2-semester series on justice and politics, looking at both ancient and modern perspectives. So, in the face of so many things going on in the world, I think to myself, I have a lot to be grateful for. We have a lot to be grateful for. So, at Houston Institute, we have a special interest on what it means for humans to thrive. So Professor Dugdale was just talking about, thriving and sociology. So that's a question that's of special interest to us. We have a special interest in questions of character, virtue, vice, and the natural law tradition. However, truth seekers from all backgrounds and perspectives are welcome. We always welcome friendly, respectful, reasoned argument about matters of substance. And that's what we hope to deliver tonight. It's precisely reasoned dialogue about matters of substance. So let me tell you a little bit about both of our speakers here. So first, let me present Professor Timothy Quill, who is the Georgia and Thomas Gosnell Distinguished Professor of Palliative Care and Professor of Medicine, Psychiatry, Medical Humanities, and Nursing at the University of Rochester School of Medicine. He was the founding director of Rochester's Palliative Care Program and is the acting director of the Paul M. Shivy Center for Bioethics. He is also a board-certified palliative care consultant in Rochester, New York. Professor Quill is the author of several books on the end of life, including Physician-Assisted Dying, The Case for Palliative Care and Patient Choice, Caring for Patients at the End of Life, Facing an Uncertain Future Together, among numerous other books and articles published in major medical journals. Professor Dugdale was mentioning that she had met Professor Quill before as an audience member. So it's a delight to have them both in conversation here. So a little bit about Professor Dugdale. So Professor Dugdale is recently minted Dorothy L. and Daniel L. Silverberg Associate Professor of Medicine at Columbia University Bagelos College of Medicine and Surgeons, and the director of the Center for Clinical Medical Ethics. She also serves as Associate Director for Clinical Ethics at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Irving Medical Center. And Professor Dugdale is a practicing internist who moved to Columbia, the university, not the country, in 2019 from Yale University, where she previously served as associate director of the program of biomedical ethics. Her scholarship focuses on end-of-life issues, medical ethics, and the doctor-patient relationship. She edited Dying in the 21st Century, came out in 2015, and is author of the recent, and by recent I mean 2020, The Lost Art of Dying Well, a popular press book on preparation for death. So I should say, so we just read several chapters of that for Houston Institute and warmly recommended. We thank Professor Dugdale for that. So that's a little bit about our speakers. So I know all the folks in the audience are not here to listen to me, you're here to listen to them. So let me tell you a little bit about the mechanics here and we can jump in. So here's the setup for tonight. So both panelists were asked to speak to the question, what does it mean to die well? So it's one of these big, ambitious questions that we love to ask. So Professor Quill will present first for about 15 to 20 minutes. Then Professor Dugdale will give her presentation also for about 15 to 20 minutes. Professor Quill will then have an opportunity to respond to Professor Dugdale for about 10 or 15 minutes. Then Professor Dugdale will respond in turn. Then finally, and this is my favorite part, we'll have about 30 minutes or so for Q&A. So that's the plan for tonight. So Professor Quill, let me turn it over to you.
Okay. Let's see. Does this work? Are you seeing my slides?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. I may not have done that correctly then.
It should be the share screen at the bottom.
Share screen at the bottom. Wait a minute. I already got this scooped up.
No problem. Absolutely no problem.
Okay, share screen at the bottom.
Yes. Oh, there we go. Fantastic.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Okay, so thank you so much, Victor, for inviting me, and Lydia for joining in this discussion, which I hope will be very fun and productive and meaningful. So we're going to try to struggle with what does it mean to die well in our modern medical environment, and what options should patients and their physicians have to facilitate that process. The bad news part of this discussion is that we're all going to actually go there at some point. And thinking about what it means to go there well, I think is a very challenging thought, particularly in American culture, where we don't like to think about these things a great deal. So, let me begin by just saying I don't have any financial conflicts of interest, but I clearly have a point of view on this subject. I'm an advocate for better palliative care in hospice and also for the possibility of a physician-assisted death as a last resort. So that's a position that I've taken for a long time as a small piece of the puzzle, in my opinion. So I like to start out with these photographs by Imogene Cunningham about people alive and functioning into their 90s. And when we use medicine's powers to keep people alive and functioning into their 90s, we are doing a wonderful thing. My oldest patient was 107 before she died, and she was independent till she was 105, and then got palliative care afterwards and maintained a pretty good quality of life, and only was on hospice for about a month before she died at 107. And it did require a non-treatment decision at the end, so it didn't just happen naturally, but it required some medical intervention, oddly enough. So we do know that we do have these wonderful treatments to help people live longer, living till maybe late 70s or even 80 on average, women till their mid 80s. But a lot of people in the latter stages of this process end up faced with, do I go on a life support or not? Maybe this man went on to this in a time where his condition was uncertain. And he was then unable to get off, and now he's trached, and now he's sort of got a big decision on his hands, and he may or may not be wanting or willing to talk about this, but he's really not going anywhere very fast at this point. So medicine has this ability to prolong life, a wonderful thing, but also can put people in predicaments in the dying process. And of course, if you happen to be Black or poor in this country, you're really not that worried about choices at the end of life, what kind of options might you have to have a peaceful death. You're really wanting to make sure you're getting access to adequate care. And if you're not doing well, there's a big question about whether somebody with better access would have access to better treatment and would be doing better than you are. So there's a real lack of trust in our system if you're poor and Black or have not had adequate health care for much of your time. So we have a very uneven health system, and that's an understatement probably. So how should a healer approach patients who have a serious illness? So if we have a notion of healing that is curing or restoring health, then it's not clear how that adapts to chronic illness. How does that fit if you can't fix a chronic illness? And is death always a medical failure if you're a healer, or is it a natural part of the life cycle? So we need, clearly, if we're going to care for people all the way through to the end of their lives, we're going to need a much broader model of healing that has more to do with maintaining personal integration and wholeness, finding meaning and maintaining connection for the latter parts of our lives. There is this opportunity for growth and closure that hospice has taught us a lot about at the end of life. Many people talk about never feeling more alive than they were at that phase of their life. But they also need committed partners, both family members and medical partners, to make this happen, because there's going to be a lot of medical challenges as people get sicker and more frail. So this seems to have disappeared, so we'll skip over this. So I love this picture because this man is on hospice probably. He's playing cards. He's probably not going to do a lot of deep death talk. He might be talking about the Yankees or the Red Sox or those kinds of things. But he's going to really find this time he spends playing cards and just shooting the breeze or watching television invaluable. And so this amazing time that can happen, sometimes it's deep existential work and meaningful work. Other times it's fairly mundane, but it still is in many ways unforgettable and very precious. And we really want to make the most of this time. There's a lot of challenges if you're caring for people toward the very end of life. There's medicines. If you don't know how to manage pain or shortness of breath or delirium, then you got real trouble on your hands. And so we really need people with expertise. So it isn't all a romantic process. Some of it's pretty tough, and you need people who know what they're doing to try to keep your symptoms down so you can potentially enjoy this phase of life. And when we do this very well and people are able to die peacefully and well, we are doing a remarkable thing. So some of you probably can imagine bad deaths that have occurred, but there are also good deaths. And these good deaths really are sacred, and they're things we really want to hang on to. So I think we all would like to have this image of our final days. But to get to this image, we're really going to have to make some good decisions along the way about when to stop medical treatment, when to transition potentially to hospice care. And then during the latter phase of hospice, we may have to boldly face some of the challenges that are undertaking. So palliative care in hospice in the United States, just to stop for a moment with some definitions, palliative care is the biological, psychological, social, and spiritual care for people whose diseases are not responsive to curative treatment. So it's really treatment of all kinds of chronic and serious diseases. The goal of palliative care is to produce the best quality of life for both the patient and the family. You notice there's not a lot of death in that definition, so that palliative care people can live a long period of time. I've cared for people on palliative care for 20 years or more in my career. They've been seriously ill for that time, but we've been maximizing their quality of life, and they've been really taking good advantage of palliative care. Hospice, on the other hand, is a Medicare and also Medicaid-sponsored program. Usually private insurance also covers it, dedicated to provide palliative care now for terminally ill patients and their families. So it's a much narrower spectrum of patients, of people who are terminally ill and who accept they're terminally ill. So the hospice model has this magic moment when you accept that you're dying, and then you give up on treatment of your disease, and you go toward relief of suffering. And this is problematic because not everybody reaches that magic moment. Many people still want to have curative treatment, even if it's improbable treatment, and even if they're quite sick and near death. So there's some real tough parts of the discussion about hospice care. So I'm an expert in hospice. I'm an enthusiast in a certain way. I think it's a really good program for the right person. But hospice requires a really bad news discussion, because I have to tell people that medical treatment isn't working and it's not likely to work, that they're more likely than not to die in the next 6 months. They're not required to die in the next 6 months, but they could die, and they're in fact more likely than not to. And to go on to hospice, they also have to give up on acute care, hospitalization, and disease-driven treatment. So many patients don't want to stop all treatment. They may be willing to stop the most burdensome treatments, but they want to continue other treatments that might help them live longer. They unfortunately then won't be able to go on to hospice. And that is because small chances of cure and longer life are at the core of hope for many people. So this has led to the palliative care movement, which really says that you get palliative treatments alongside disease-directed therapies. You might say midway through this decide, gee, I really don't want to do the most aggressive things. I might not want CPR or go onto a ventilator, but I'm still willing to go to the hospital. And then as you get to the right-hand side of palliative care, disease-directed therapies become less and less helpful and meaningful, and that then you may begin getting pure palliative care, which would be the time to transition to hospice. So the palliative care discussion is a little bit different discussion than the hospice discussion, because you're still going to be hoping for the best. You're going to search for medical treatments that might help. It might include improbable or experimental treatment. If you are going to try long shot treatment, we want to make sure you're fully informed about the risks and benefits in those decisions. And at the same time, we're going to pay careful attention to the present to make sure pain and symptoms are fully managed, attend to depression and psychosocial issues to try to maximize quality of life. And still at the same time, we're going to prepare just in case these treatments don't work. So make sure your affairs are settled if you're interested in doing those kinds of things. If there is unfinished business with your family, issues that need to be talked about, we give people the opportunity to do that. And they can explore spiritual and existential issues if they want to. And they can do this at the same time they're receiving disease-directed therapy. So you don't necessarily have to go to hospice to do some of the meaningful work that's entailed in hospice. So when should palliative care then be discussed? The surprised question, would you be surprised if a patient died during this hospitalization? I will tell you, if I take a look at the people that I see in the hospital right now in acute hospitals, there's not a lot of them that I would see who aren't just in there for a procedure, who I would be surprised if they died in the hospitalization. So they are at risk. Usually it's waited. We wait for this discussion until people are imminently dying. And the one that we should probably have a bigger awareness of is the patients that have high level of suffering, a poor prognosis, and nobody's talking about what's really going on. And trying to get that discussion out in the open, I think, can be a real service. So if you ask the question, would you be surprised if the patient died in the next six months? We're going to then try to address people who have significant suffering, regardless of prognosis, people who are afraid of pain and suffering. And then maybe we should just make this a part of anybody with a potentially life-threatening illness. And that's probably where palliative care really is. Not all palliative care has to be done by specialists. So we are learning more and more about early palliative care, potentially prolonging life and enhancing quality of life. And we're doing more and more at our shop and most of the hospitals, at least the academic centers, about teaching good doctors to do the basics of palliative care so that more people can get it as a piece of the puzzle wherever they are on the trajectory of their life. So we're also going to try to guide people through this. So there is a whole movement in medicine, the patient autonomy movement, which says that maybe we shouldn't be suggesting or making too much recommendation for patients, that we should give them options and choices and let them decide. And I will tell you that I'm very opposed to that. I think when we put a series of choices in front of people and don't give them any guidance, we're really not doing them a great favor. We really want to teach doctors and trainees to really try to influence patients and families back and forth. Patients and families, the experts, and the patient as a person, their values, what's important to them. And then clinicians have expertise in medical matters, including prognosis and options. And true autonomy will really require that they really mix it up, that they share expertise, that physicians share their experience and sometimes recommendations based on their knowledge of the patient as a person and their clinical expertise, but ultimately then patients make a choice about which treatment they're going to want or not want. So then what are my options if suffering becomes unacceptable? So this is the smaller question, but sometimes equally important, sometimes of greater importance. So who cares about last resort options? Why are they important? So many people who have had other people in their families have witnessed bad death. So if you take a look at your extended family, back generations and the people you know, you probably have seen some very good deaths, some not so good deaths. Some families talk about these matters, some families don't talk about it at all. But those who have witnessed a bad death, as they get sicker, start to worry about these things. And they may wonder, what choices might I have if I get into that circumstance? And for them, for some of them at least, the possibility of an escape if suffering becomes unacceptable is very important. So awareness of what options could be important to some patients, families, and caregivers. And the only way to find that out is to open the door to this discussion with patients and families. So again, as people get sicker, they need to know who is they're going to be their main treating doctor throughout this process. This is a real issue in American healthcare. We have a lot of people at the table, but it's not always clear who's going to be present. The primary care doctors are often not present in the hospital. The hospitalist may be present in some parts of the hospital, but not in the ICU. So ideally, there ought to be somebody who's going to be continually present. Palliative care sometimes does serve this role. Primary care doctors sometimes stay involved in this way. And I think if you have such a person, you really have a leg up in this process. That person can be a guide and a partner. And as people get sicker, we can talk with them about what they're most afraid of, what death might look like, what kind of deaths they've seen. If they've seen hard deaths, we could talk about how we'd approach those if that happens to them and reassure them that we do have answers for many of these things. And those who know who they're going to be working with and that person is not going to be afraid to address some tough things if suffering occurs, really are free then to worry about other matters like fighting their disease or living their life fully or both. But it also may come up where people really are ready to die now and people will talk to us about these things. They may ask us, I feel like this is my time. I really can't stand doing this anymore. And the first step to go with this is to ask why now, tell me the worst part, to try to find the meaning of this request. And if the meaning is, you know, I'm having this pain I haven't told you about and it's driving me crazy and I find life not worth living, then the first step is to go redouble your efforts to relieve their pain or shortness of breath or delirium or weakness. They may also have a psychosocial problem. They may have family issues that they haven't surfaced, that their families are no longer able to take care of them at home or there are huge problems at home, in which case the answer is to try to find someone to help them deal with those issues. They may have a spiritual or religious crisis, wondering how a caring God could have put them in this position. And again, we might try to find somebody who is knowledgeable about these issues, a chaplain or somebody from their faith tradition to have a meaningful conversation around these issues. They may have become depressed so that they're not seeing their situation clearly or anxious. And then the answer is to redouble efforts to treat anxiety and depression. But it also may be that they're experiencing uncontrolled, intolerable suffering. And in that case, their bad death should be considered a medical emergency. It should put us into high gear trying to figure out ways of responding. And then if there aren't other simpler ways to solve these issues, then we might begin a discussion about what are some of the last resort options where somebody might be able to find death more quickly. So again, if they're in severe pain, we may be able to take the risk of higher doses of pain-relieving medications, even if that might shorten their life. If it relieves their suffering, that would be permissible in almost every ethical circumstance, as long as our intent is to relieve the pain or shortness of breath and not intending to hasten their death. If they're on life-sustaining therapy, they could stop those treatments, even if their desire is to die sooner. So people have a right to say what kind of things are done to their body. They can also say no to those things. And again, we can have a meaningful discussion about whatever treatments. And some of those are the big ones, like a ventilator or CPR, but it also might be things like dialysis, or it might be things like heart failure treatment that could theoretically be stopped if a patient was prepared to die. In the middle area are some newer gray options, I would say. They're more ethically controversial. So people might have the option of stopping eating and drinking. This is different from the gradual stopping eating and drinking that is a natural part of the dying process, but it actually is somebody really deciding to completely stop eating and drinking as a way to hasten death. And again, there's been a lot more discussion about this recently in both ethical and religious and legal circles, and it seems like it's legally permitted and I would say ethically still controversial in some some circumstances. Palliative sedation is also a way of dealing with severe symptoms. When you look at how frequently palliative sedation is done between medical centers, there's huge variation. In some places, it's done about 50% of deaths, and in other places, it's done very rarely, 1% or 2% of deaths. And I will tell you, if there's that much variation, that does not have to do with patients. It has to do with the clinicians who are driving this possibility. But in point of fact, this is a way of dealing with some of the tougher situations, and it is ethically permissible. Should be challenging, should be rare, but is a possibility. And then there is physician-assisted death, where the doctor would give the patient on their request, who's terminally ill, medication they can take at a time of their own choosing to hasten their own death. This is now legal in eight states in the District of Columbia. In the United States and all of Canada and other places in Western Europe. And then finally, voluntary active euthanasia, where the patient would make a request to the clinician to hasten their death, but then the clinician would deliver the medicine that would end the patient's life. Illegal in the United States and likely to be prosecuted, but legal in all of Canada and the Netherlands and several other Western European countries. So some data from Oregon, which has the most data from in the United States in terms of length of time in this practice. It accounts for 1 in 300 deaths. It might be a little higher than that now. It's probably closer to 1 in 100 deaths. But 1 in 50 talk to their doctors about it, and 1 in 6 talk to their families about it. So most people actually want to talk. They want to know that there could be options. They want to know how we'd respond, but very few ultimately act, even in places where it is legal. So should last resort options be routinely discussed with all seriously ill patients? From my point of view, the answer is probably not. This kind of discussion would frighten some patients. It might be perceived to be pressure to prematurely choose death. It might undermine progress in hospice and palliative care, and it could undermine fundamental physician values. So it probably shouldn't be discussed with everyone, but it clearly should be discussed when patients ask about their options for hastening death or when they clearly show an interest. It takes a certain amount of courage to ask these questions from patients, and when they ask them, we ought to be forthright in the way that we respond to those questions. So I'm going to close with some thoughts and a vision about what things might look like toward the end of life. One of our powers is to prolong life, but we also have this a sobering power to prolong dying. And again, look in any hospital right now in the country, including ours, and you'll see examples of wonderful and not so wonderful things on both sides of the spectrum. We have potential to relieve suffering, but we also can really aggravate suffering. So when we're really using very aggressive treatments that are not likely to benefit patients, we are often aggravating suffering, and there's not going to be a positive outcome. So this is really a sobering part of medicine, and why palliative care, as you get into those kinds of circumstances, should become a part of the puzzle to help us sort through the suffering part about this and make sure that the patient really wants to keep going with the treatments that are keeping going. We have the potential to offer meaningful choices to patients and families, but we also have the possibility of offering many insubstantial choices. So one more round of chemotherapy that's extremely unlikely to work, or some added use of pressors or other treatments that might have a tiny chance of working, but more likely are not going to. It's fine to do these things, but we ought to be sure people know the odds are very poor and that we ought to make sure that palliative care is being provided at the same time. sometimes we do help people fight death, and it's a very exhilarating process to fight death with patients. But we also may at sometimes help people find death. And when people are ready for death, helping them find a way to achieve death can be an equally meaningful process in the right circumstances, provided it is being guided by the patient's values and circumstances. So in my view, a bad death should be considered a medical emergency. And so when you see a bad death in the hospital, and again, you don't have to look too far in most hospitals to find this, clinicians really need to work harder to find acceptable ways of respond without violating fundamental values. So this requires a teamwork between disease-directed treatment, specialists, palliative care, clinicians, ethicists, depending on the circumstances, to try to find a way forward that would be the best possible under sometimes very daunting circumstances. Clinicians should be a committed guide and partner as the illness progresses. So again, often as people get sicker, there's a lot of people involved, but there's nobody really guiding the patient and family and really helping them sort through all the options. So this is really key. Sometimes in the ICU, there are ICU docs who really step up and do that role, and that's a wonderful thing when they do. Sometimes it's palliative care doctors. Sometimes it could be the patient's primary care physician who steps in as almost a family member with expertise. So finally, I'd say that helping people die well is a legitimate goal of medicine. So again, since we're all going to go there eventually, learning how to do the last part of this process as well as we possibly can is something medicine needs to keep working on and keeping trying to find a better way to do it. So with that, I will stop.
Great. Thank you so much to Professor Timothy Quill. And we'll jump right into Professor Dugdale's presentation.
Wonderful. Can you hear me, Victor, okay?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Well, I also extend my thanks to you and the Houston Institute, as well as to Dr. Quill for joining me tonight. For those of you outside of medicine, Dr. Quill is a legend, and so it's a delight for me to be with him tonight. I like to start with this painting, and if we were in person, I would ask who knows who painted it, but I wrote it on the slide, since we can't really talk. And it's a painting by Hieronymus Bosch, who often painted images that evoked the ephemerality of life. This idea, as Dr. Quill said, that we're all going to go there. And so how are we going to think about our preparation for death? And this is called Death in the Miser, the name of the painting. And what you see in the foreground is the miser when he was in a much healthier, more robust state. And there he is in his green-brown tunic, reaching his hand into a bag of money that's being clutched by some sort of demon, kind of little evil-looking creature. And you can see underneath the chest, there are more of such creatures. And the miser has around his waist a key, which presumably is the key to that chest. And this is a much actually longer, narrower painting. And so if I had showed you the whole image, you would see that there is evidence in the foreground of him being a much more robust person, perhaps a soldier with some amount of armor and things like that. So he was well-to-do, he was well-off, he was robust, he fought. There he is, though, in the background in bed, pale, emaciated, looking rather fragile. He's being accompanied by an angel who's desperately trying to get him to look up. And if you could see above, you would see the image of a crucifix. So the angel's trying to point him up to God, but instead his gaze is fixed on death itself, who is coming in at the door. And his right hand is extended down to a bag of money, suggesting that even in his dying, he cannot relinquish his attachment to earthly possessions. So these sorts of images were just to get people to think about, what do you value? Where are your commitments? What are your loves? And how are you going to take that with you or not when the end comes? This is where I'm going to go to talk about dying poorly, then to talk about dying well, and then to talk about whether we could revive this art of dying well. And part of this is based on the work, the scholarly work I've been doing for the last dozen or so years. So we'll get started. I'm going to give you a case which medical doctors often like to do, and it's to sort of paint the picture or give an illustration. So this is a gentleman I took care of when I was at Yale, and he was a very old, emaciated also, rather scrawny man, full of prostate cancer. It was everywhere in his body, and in fact, he had come back into the hospital because the cancer had spread into his bones and into his brain. And he was very confused and we say altered. He had an altered mental status. And so his daughters brought him in. And when I met him, he was actually dead because I was a part of the team of doctors called to resuscitate patients whose hearts had stopped. And I remember him because we resuscitate a lot of people in the hospital, but I remember this particular case because his heart stopped three times that night. So he died three times in the same night. And we were able to successfully resuscitate him the first two times, but the third time we weren't. And you might say, well, why is this an illustration of dying poorly? And the answer to that is because when we first met him, seeing him elderly and very frail and in very poor health, malnourished in every way, full of cancer, we knew straight away that resuscitation would not work. It would not be effective in this gentleman. Yes, we might be able to restart his heart momentarily, which we did. It lasted for about an hour to 2 hours each time, but it would not ultimately lead to him sort of flourishing, to living, to even getting out of the hospital. And there was nothing that we could do to alter his course of this very advanced progressive cancer that wouldn't get better. And so for us as physicians, it felt like we were inflicting harm on a dying man, that in fact we were causing more trauma. And for those of you who've been a part of such resuscitations, it can be quite traumatic. So this was a story that stuck with me. And you know, the truth of the matter is that most people, so when we think about dying poorly, we can parse this out several different ways. So most people want to die at home. Stanford Palliative Care says that the number is 80%. I don't know where they got that. So I like this number from the Kaiser Family Foundation of 71%. And then there's another study that was published in the Journal of Palliative Care of advanced cancer patients. And more than half of them say they want to die at home. But here's the truth, is that about 60% of people die in institutions. And if you look at this graph, it compares 2003 with 2017. And you see that in 2003, the blue line on top, about 40% of people died in the hospital. And by 2017, 30% died in the hospital. This is part of the reason this study, it was in the New England Journal, it made big news. Actually, the New York Times and other popular newspapers covered it because it was so extraordinary that we had dropped that many hospital deaths during that time period. So what increased? Well, in fact, we had an increase in deaths at home from that's the orange line, from 24% to 31%. Nursing facilities didn't change much, dropped a tiny bit from 24 to 21%, but we have this large rise in hospice facilities, the purple line at the bottom, from almost nothing in 2003 to 8.3% in 2017. So there's some good news to see, fewer hospital deaths, but overall, most people want to die at home, but still more than half of people, about 60%, die in institutions. There's another way to think about dying poorly, and that is this question of advanced directives. Now, these are the forms that some people fill out with their lawyers, but you don't, in fact, have to go to a lawyer. Most state government websites have access to forms. And these are forms that enable you, while you're healthy and of sound mind, to articulate what your wishes might be with regard to life extending or life sustaining therapies or treatments when you become unable to articulate your own wishes. So you could say now, I definitely want my heart restarted and I definitely want artificial nutrition and hydration and I want everything. Or you might decide that you've been through something before and you don't want to pursue everything. So this might manifest as someone deciding he knows his kidneys are in a bad way, but he never wants dialysis. And he can complete an advance directive now that states, if my kidneys give out entirely. I do not want to be on dialysis. So there are things like this that one can talk through with one's physician and then prepare these advanced directives in advance. Now, most people, and this is a study of almost 800,000 people, most people don't have advanced directives. In fact, only about 35 to 40% do. And this is particularly a problem in racial and ethnic minority communities. And so here again, from Kaiser Family Foundation, we see that this was based on a national survey of about 1,000 people. But non-Hispanic Blacks, only about 15% reported that they had advanced directives, and Hispanics, only about 11%. So in terms of, Dr. Quill made reference to the disparities at the end of life, which we saw in and have been seeing in real time with COVID, these are sort of across the board, and it's something that those of us in medicine do take very seriously and are actively working to mitigate. But there is a much lower uptake of advanced directives among these communities. So going back to our gentleman then, you know, what is the takeaway? The takeaway is that many people are often poorly prepared for death. I am not a palliative care specialist, in contrast to Dr. Quill, but I'm an internal medicine doctor. So I'm your primary care GP, and many of my patients I've taken care of for many years and have seen them regularly. And we have these conversations really quite frequently. It's actually a requirement of Medicare to talk about this at least once a year. And so what do I mean by poorly prepared for death? Yes, it might be dying in a hospital when you want to die at home. It might be not having advanced directives. It might be not having gotten any of your documents in order. Dr. Quill referenced this. It might be failing to reconcile with family members from whom you are estranged, or it might be failing to even consider any of the big questions of life. You know, what am I here? What does this mean? What brings me meaning? What is life for? What happens when I die? Those sorts of questions. I have definitely cared for patients who sort of save that up for the end, and often trying to work through some of those big questions when one is suffering from advanced illness is very complicated and often ineffective. So as a primary care doctor, I've been trying to work with my patients to sort of think through these things while they're healthy and able to. So then there's another case, and I bring this case up to sort of tie to this bigger question of the preparation for death. So we're in Florence, Italy in the mid 14th century. And this is a quotation from Giovanni Boccaccio, the Italian humanist who lived through the mid 14th century outbreak of bubonic plague and described it. The people were uniformly affected by these large collections of lymph nodes and large lymph nodes in the groin and in the armpits, size of an apple, perhaps the size of an egg. They were just teeming with the bacteria that caused bubonic plague, or otherwise known as the Black Death. And I want to just spend a quick second on this etching by Luigi Sabatelli, another Italian artist. And you can see in Italian at the bottom, it says, "The Plague of Florence, as described by Boccaccio," this Italian humanist I mentioned. And Sabatelli did this presumably in the early 1800s. I don't have a date for it. But here we are outside of the walls of Florence. And you can see in the foreground slightly to the right, there is a heap of dead bodies, right? A heap of corpses, and even just over to the left, a man carrying out a stretcher. It might be a funeral bier, but a stretcher of sorts with a couple of corpses on it, and he's just dumping them in the pile of bodies, right? This is suggesting that death was so rampant that the move was just to get rid of bodies and to not leave them inside the city walls. In the background, it looks like there are a collection of grave diggers waiting for work. And perhaps these are in the foreground on the left, clergy of some sort, priests. It might be one holding a Bible there. So addressing some of these spiritual questions that death necessarily evokes. So here we have a picture of a plague doctor. And if you think it looks like a bird, it's true that this mask was meant to evoke the image of an Egyptian divinity, because the Egyptian divinities that were looked like birds were presumably to thwart off disease. But the beak of the mask had a double function. That is, the doctors would stuff herbs and spices inside that beak so that when they approached the patient whose body was teeming with bacteria and whose flesh was decaying, the smell would not put the doctor off, but the doctor could actually mitigate the smell through the herbs and spices in the beak. There were glass sort of goggles in the eye sockets, and the whole thing was a waxed leather robe, completely covered. And it's worth noting that historians vary on their estimates, but this mid-14th century outbreak of plague affected as many as two-thirds of Europeans. And here you see, you know, we haven't changed our approach much in the 21st century. This sort of COVID gear is the kind of gear that many of us have worn throughout the pandemic. And again, this attempt, when we don't really know much about the inciting agent, to really protect ourselves. And we described our experiences with ethics consultations during the height of the pandemic at our medical center in New York City. But what was interesting about this is not only did our consultations quadruple during the height of the pandemic, but the vast majority of them were focused on end-of-life issues, a lot of distress around trying to know what to do at the end of life. And so I'm going to pivot now from this dying poorly, which is not only a 14th century phenomenon or a 2006 phenomenon, but is something that I've seen very vividly during the pandemic. And I'm going to talk a bit about the art of dying well. So after this mid-14th century outbreak of plague, because so many people died, there arose this concern among the masses, really, that the plague would come back and they would not be adequately prepared. And, you know, this was a very religious society at the time. In part, the leading social authority was the church, the Western church. And so the people sort of turned to the clergy and said, you need to help us make sense of this. You need to give us some tools, because if the priests die or if they skip town, who's going to serve us last rites? Who's going to help us prepare? Who's going to conduct the funeral masses? And so the response was, eventually, it took actually about 50 or 60 years for the church to sort of issue a response. In part, that was because of some internal problems with multiple popes. But once that was resolved, the church issued some handbooks on the preparation for death. Now, I say the church, we actually don't even know who wrote the very first version, the oldest copy of which we have dates back to 1415. But we think it was influenced by someone who had met at the Council of Constance to help resolve this problem with the popes. So what do these handbooks have? The very first iterations had prayers both for the dying person and for the community members, protocols to attend to the dying, again, for all members of the community. They had a sort of a catechism or a Q&A, if you will, sort of what do you believe, with a response to help people who were kind of not sure about these spiritual questions make sense of them. The overarching theme was that if you want to die well, you have to live well. And living well means attending to these questions and attending to sort of one's conduct throughout life, one's relationships, one's community, one's God throughout life, and not leaving that until the very last moment. The very first iterations focused a lot on what they described as the five temptations that faced the dying. Interestingly, this did not include a fear of death, but the five temptations that the dying faced included impatience, greed, doubt, despair, and what's the last one? I'm forgetting it. But they were paired with consolations or comforts. So this was in both the text version, which I said dated to 1415, and then the illustrated version, the earliest copy of which dates to about 1450. And these were, they were woodcuts. And by 1450, of course, we had the printing press. So they were quickly printed and circulated around Europe. The Ars Moriendi was adopted and adapted by other religious groups and was in wide circulation for about 500 years. It's worth noting that after the Protestant Reformation, there were Protestant versions. There subsequently developed Jewish versions. Drew Faust, the former president of Harvard University, is a Civil War historian. And in her work on the Civil War, she talks about how by the 1800s, if you were brought up well, attending to the preparation for death was just part of what you did. So today the equivalent might be, you know, estate planning. If you're brought up well, you sort of make sure you got your financial stuff in order. Back then it was this kind of holistic, community focused, not also including sort of religious questions. It was this kind of holistic preparation. It didn't mean that everyone was religious. There were certainly non-religious versions of the Ars Moriendi, but it was this idea that you need to attend to these questions. You need to get to a place of peace on some of these questions, and you have to do that work while you're healthy. So there are lots of reasons I could go into for why the Ars Moriendi fell out of favor, and I won't go through that in detail right now. So the question that's been driving me, I discovered this Ars Moriendi genre of literature maybe a dozen years ago and wrote a little essay on it and then was asked to do a book, which was the first book, which is very academic and edited. And my patients really didn't want to read it. And so I subsequently was asked to do a book that would be much more user-friendly, that would draw on these themes of plague and mass death, and how we make sense of our finitude and our mortality and what we should do now sort of in the everyday to prepare for death. I finished the manuscript a year and a half ago and had no idea we would be in the midst of a pandemic when it was published, but there you have it. So I've been really driven by this question of, can we revive the art of dying, especially in a way that speaks across difference and speaks across religious and non-religious, that speaks across culture, and what would sort of be fundamental to that sort of art of dying. So that's the book. And here's the whole book in three bullet points. There, and this gets to a lot of what Dr. Quill just talked about. So I'll go quickly and then we'll have time for a Q&A too. So there's this question of advanced directives. I also talk a lot in the last chapter about frailty. There are some really good frailty risk scores that you don't have to be a doctor to use. You can get a really good sense of, say, how mom is doing by thinking through these markers of frailty. And what they help a person do is know whether, for example, I should elect aggressive chemotherapy or I should elect aggressive surgery, maybe for me or for my elderly parent. Do we want to pursue that? Is mom too frail? Is she not? These kinds of questions. And so thinking about frailty and all of these kind of medical health questions, I strongly urge people to take up with either their primary care doctors, palliative care doctors like Dr. Quill, or in the context of friends or family members who can give advice, who are trained to give advice on this sort of thing. And then there are these questions of home. One of the core elements of the Ars Moriendi, or this art of dying, is that no one should die alone, which isn't to say that, you know, sometimes people are surrounded by family, the family members go home and then the person dies. That's not what I mean by dying alone, but I mean really the lonely dying, that living and dying is a community affair, that we are relational creatures, we are social creatures. And so dying well, as with living well, means working out those relationships. So there's so much to say about working through beliefs collectively in community, but also working out the difficulties too. And so reconciliation is a big thing, and it actually comes up frequently in this genre of literature, is sort of gathering people at the bedside of the dying person and really trying to reconcile. And I would submit that that is not stuff you should save up until the end, but actually by reconciling now with loved ones, with friends, there's the possibility of having much richer relationships going forward over the course of the remainder of one's life. Also working through rituals and practices. And then the big questions, what Dr. Quill called the spiritual or existential questions, questions of life and death and afterlife. And, you know, I had a gentleman contact me a week or so ago and say, he said, you know, I read your book. Can I talk to you about it? I said, sure. So we set up a call and he said, I want you to know, you talk about the need to think about these spiritual questions. I said, yeah, I do. He said, I want you to know I'm a committed atheist. I said, that's fine. Like, I just want people to think about it. If you are secure in your atheism and that is what gives you comfort, then I'm not out to persuade you otherwise. He said, well, I took Pascal's wager. And, you know, Pascal famously says, you know, wager that there's God. And if you're right, you know, you win, and wager that there's not God and you're wrong, then you really lose, right? I mean, this, I'm not quoting him very well, but it's that kind of thing. He said, so I took Pascal's wager and I'm an elder in my church. And I thought, well, there you go. You know, he's both an elder in his church and he's a committed atheist. It feels like a paradox, but he's giving it some thought and he's sort of actively thinking through these things. And that's what I encourage my patients to do, and my friends and family, frankly, to work, wrestle with these questions in the context of community. And the possibility for dying well, I think, becomes all the more achievable. So with that, I will stop and thank you so much for your attention.
Fantastic. Thank you to Professor Dugdale. So let's see here. So I think Professor Quill has a few minutes for a brief response to Professor Dugdale, then Professor Dugdale will do her response.
Okay, so I really enjoyed your talk. So there's not a lot that I disagree with about it, but I'll make a few thoughts or a few points about it. Your case number one, who had CPR times three at the very end of life. I used to think that was a complete medical failure when this happened in my case, because I saw my role as protecting people against, you know, harsh treatments that were not going to work. I still try to protect people, but I've also learned because some of my patients have taught me that, you know, after I've tried CPR the third time and it finally didn't work, they've thanked me so much for not giving up on them and for trying so hard. And particularly for people who have been poor and haven't had access, who don't necessarily trust the system, the mountain they have to climb to get to do not resuscitate or get to hospice may be just simply too high. And the fight is extremely meaningful to them. And that battle is seen as tremendously valuable to them sometimes and their families. So it's, my mind has had to expand in that area. The bubonic plague and COVID. I was thinking about ethics consultations in the COVID world. You know, what do we do with these people who are, you know, at home alone and don't really know how to approach what's going on, who are in denial about the presence of COVID? Do we confront that denial? Do we let them live with it? And the images of the bubonic plague strike me of the images of the various political rallies we're seeing now on either sides of this crazy view of a real tragic epidemic that's going on. How we put a lens on it that is very just polarizing. And anyway, it brought that up for me. Religion. Is a very important piece of the puzzle for many people. So help families find meaning, attending to the preparation for death. Can it help them prepare? So One of the things that I have come to to understand, though, is that many religious practitioners, or priests and clergy, are so frightened of death. They're as frightened of death as everybody else is. And so they are not that comfortable around death. And so the notion that they're going to be guiding folks in terms of making meaning out of this process, they're struggling with their own struggles with this. So one of our jobs, I think, is to work a lot more with clergy of all stripes to get them into the hospital, have them, again, that's a little harder to do now, but and maybe get the discussions about better end of life care out into the various different churches, because, and clergy, I don't think are going to guide this discussion. I think they're going to have to be brought along. Maybe my experience in this is different than others. And then finally, the art of dying, I think we're still all trying to figure that out. How can we do that better? Clearly there's areas of improvement. There are areas where it's done wonderfully. I think the one stimulating thought that I thought I have is, you know, it maybe COVID is going to open some of this up a little bit. So there may be some positives about COVID. We're all at home a lot more with our families. You know, we're not running around every second. And we're making contact maybe in a different way with our grandparents or, you know, different generations. And maybe this is going to open up some conversation about what's important in life for all of us. You know, maybe running around the way we have, maybe even if we find a cure for COVID, maybe we shouldn't go back to what we've been doing quite as much as we were doing it anyway. So I just think, and the art of dying might be an avenue to think about that. How could we do that better with our loved ones now? And I do think that's going to get opened up, because it's pretty clear you don't want to go to the hospital if you're dying. And, you know, are we going to be home? We're going to be able to take care of people at home. You want to go to a nursing home now with all that's going on there? So it does open up a lot of possibilities of thinking more creatively about these things. So those are just some loose associations to what I was very stimulated by your talk.
That's great. Thank you so much. Yeah. And maybe just a very couple, I know I'm not supposed to really respond to your comments, but I'm going to just quickly. I agree 100% that sometimes the fight is exactly what people need, and it's consistent with how they've lived. And especially, as you know, the data with racial and ethnic minorities, it shows that these communities tend to prefer much more aggressive end of life measures. And I think for some of the reasons you raised, that it's taken so long for them to get the care that they need and deserve, that at the end, you know, there's no will to give up, like not to have maximum technology. So I think that's right. As much as we as doctors don't want to inflict what we sometimes see as additional harm from our technology. The clergy piece is interesting. There's some research that's been done out of Harvard by Michael Balboni and Tracy Balboni, examining what exactly it is with clergy. And their conclusion has been that, if I'm quoting them correctly, that in not wanting to have parishioners give up on God or lose hope, they encourage them to continue with life-sustaining therapy. Their first study shows that those who are highly religious are much more likely to prefer aggressive end-of-life measures. And so they were trying to explore, what is it? Why is it that people who are well-supported by religious communities want to die in the ICU? What's going on there? And so part of it is clergy who perhaps aren't as literate in the ways of the hospital don't want to discourage their parishioners, their faithful. And so they continue to encourage them to pursue aggressive treatments. But anyway, much to say there, much to sort out. I would just say, you know, I agree with so much of your work. And particularly, I think what I focused on, Dr. Quill, is this idea of how should a healer approach patients with serious illness. And I agree with you about this broader model of healing that is a model that looks at integration and wholeness and finding meaning, opportunity for growth and closure, commitment to face the unknown together. And, you know, my understanding of medicine is that our commitments to patients, is their healing or their flourishing, as we were talking about before we started tonight. Indeed, I would say that I understand the aim of medicine to be health. And I guess where I get tripped up with your work is thinking about how the last resort options, and specifically euthanasia and physician assisted death, how these last resort options comport with a commitment to healing. And I know there are people who are probably saying, well, that's weird. You know, we're talking about dying people. So what does healing have to do with it? Except that, you know, even the definition of palliative care that you gave us of the biopsychosocial and spiritual care of those whose disease is not responsive to curative treatment, that is an image of healing. So I feel like palliative care gets us to healing, but euthanasia and physician-assisted death or physician-assisted suicide doesn't seem to comport with healing. And so when I guess when I think about those, part of the reason that they don't is because it seems to me very antithetical to the profession of medicine. So for example, when we as doctors take the Hippocratic Oath, you know, we swear that we won't tell our patients secrets, right? We maintain their privacy. We won't have sex with them. That's in the Hippocratic Oath. And we won't poison them, even if they ask for it. So, you know, for thousands of years, doctors have been saying we won't poison our patients. We'll maintain solidarity with the sick and vulnerable. We won't abandon them. And yet these palliative options of last resort don't seem to do that. It seems to violate, in a sense, these promises that we make to our patients and not work towards health. And then I guess, you know, I have some other concerns, which are things like copycat suicides, which are well documented both in the you know, conventional suicide literature as well as in the physician-assisted dying literature. There's a study out of Switzerland that showed this, that older folks were had significant increases in their rates of poisoning in Switzerland, meaning both physician-assisted suicide as well as unassisted suicide. There are data out of Australia that, you know, show that young people are, even where euthanasia is illegal, and even when it was illegal in Australia, that young people were getting advice from, you know, Exit International folks to learn how to acquire the euthanasia drugs and were self-ingesting them as acts of conventional suicide, but they were, in a sense, partnering and getting advice from the physician-assisted suicide people. And I think that's concerning. And then there's this, you know, sort of age-old description of the slippery slope, which is, you know, that we start with just a few people for limited reasons, you know, and I know, Dr. Cole, you've been so careful in terms of describing that this is, you know, last resort and not for everyone. And I have enormous respect for that. But again, when we look at sort of Belgium or the Netherlands, we see a massive increase over the years in people who are electing euthanasia. I mean, now in the Netherlands, it's like 1 in 20 dies by euthanasia. And then the reasons for euthanasia are not just end of life. It's not just a terminal diagnosis, but it's, you know, people who are not terminally ill, people who are tired of life. There have been a lot of calls for that. Children in Belgium can be euthanized if they're suffering and they request euthanasia and their parents okay it. So this sort of slippery slope phenomenon. So these kind of, you know, several things give me pause when I think about my work as a physician aimed toward healing, and then seeing that these last resort practices don't get me to healing. And in fact, there are other reasons that they should give me pause. Not only do they not seem to fit with the profession of medicine, but they seem to be contributing to a culture of suicide and pushing us further down the slippery slope. So I say all this with a lot of humility, knowing that you are very, very experienced at all of this, and I'm not a palliative care doctor, but I guess these are the things that give me pause, and I would love to be able to talk about this.
Great. So In official capacity, we jump into Q&A, but Tim, did you want to get a word in briefly?
Sure, I'll put a few words on the table. Just to say, you know, the arguments that you're making were made when we were 25 years ago when we were having the discussion ethically about whether people could be taken off of life supports, whether they could stop life support. There are most expensive patients. Maybe they're the too much pressure to take them off of life supports. Maybe they won't be making their own decisions. In my view, that has so not come to pass. I mean, when you look at what we do when we take people off life supports, at least at our shop, and I think in most American hospitals, there is really good thought. There's good documentation about why we're doing it when we do it. We get consultation. So the model of having an open process with consultation, with documentation, it seems to me is the best counter to some of the slippery slope arguments. Again, I realize that it's not the only argument, and you could subtly or manipulate those things. But I think it's a good example of that process working on our most expensive patients. Again, I also personally believe that people are wanting to have these conversations, and getting this conversation out in the open is a huge plus. And again, I think anytime we're doing something that potentially hastens death, we can't just say, well, we can't do that, so you're on your own, or what you really need is more palliative care. I think we have to get into a deep exploration of this. And if we are looking for ways of responding that might potentially hasten death, I think the best protection against the slippery slope, in my opinion, is to get very experienced people out there. You can make the safeguards more complex, again, so you could require a psychiatric opinion, you could require a palliative care opinion or a second palliative care opinion. So maybe that's a way of counteracting that. Another piece of this puzzle, though, is also with our treatments, we have increased the probability of people reaching a point that they are literally falling apart before we're even having a stopping conversation. So the number of peaceful deaths where people make a timely decision, go into hospice in a timely way, it happens, but it's really exceptional, and you have to be pretty exceptional to do that, because the juggernaut of more treatment is so strong in medicine. So the big question for me is open process versus secret process. And I firmly believe that open processes are way safer than secret processes. But there's no risk-free way forward here for sure.
That's right. So that's actually a great transition into our Q&A period. So I would encourage folks, if you see in the bottom of your Zoom screen where you see chat, ignore that button with great zeal. Hop along two sides and see Q&A. That's the button you want. So Q&A button. And I would especially encourage undergraduate and medical students to give us your questions for Dr. Dugdale and Dr. Quill. This is really a golden opportunity. So I'm actually going to start here with a question that kind of picks up where the discussion here. So this is from Brett Seeley Hacker, and it's a question for both Dr. Dugdale and Dr. Quill. So it begins asking Dr. Quill and then Dr. Dugdale. Dr. Quill, what is your assessment of the state of physician-assisted dying and euthanasia in Canada and the Western European nations where it is legal and more regularly practiced? Is it desirable? If not, how would you propose we maintain your more nuanced take on the issue? Dr. Dugdale, how slippery do you believe this slope is to be and why? So how slope is the slippery slope? So Tim, we'll throw it to you, and then we'll throw it to Lydia.
Well, the pluses of the Canadian and the Dutch system and most of the systems that have an open practice is that, number one, they have universal health care, right? So people are not going to be choosing this because they didn't have access to health care. They by and large have access. And in that context, it's really a question of if they have access to good health care and they reach this point, do we want how flexible do we want to be to have people have ways of responding? So again, what I see in palliative care consultation, a fair number of people who are approaching this question, wanting reassurance about the a future. And if they are in that group that really is ready to stop now, and it's not inadequate palliative care, and it's not mental illness, then it's, in my mind, it's partly a question of what are the methods that are going to be effective at responding to their situation and that are also legal. So I'm really looking for options that really allow us to better respond to the particular patient situation. And what we do now is sort of try to fit something in. So you know, the stopping eating and drinking, which is legal, it becomes an option. It may not be the most elegant approach, but it is under the patient's own control. And we are having people do that. They do that partly because some people do it because they would never do assisted suicide for religious reasons, and they don't view this as assisted suicide. I had a nun who stopped eating and drinking, and she viewed it as a fast for God. She didn't view it as suicide. So there are ways where we are trying to tailor the options we give people to what's available and to their values. And I, the more options I think we can agree upon being available, I think it gives people a little bit better quality of death potentially.
Great. So how slippery is the slippery slope? I think it's definitely more slippery in Belgium and the Netherlands for the reasons that I gave. You can be euthanized for so many reasons now. It doesn't have to be really end of life at all. And that's concerning. One in 20 deaths in the Netherlands from euthanasia seems like a lot to me. I know that when this data came out, actually the first round of it came out in 2013, a couple of bioethicists, Art Kaplan and Baron Lerner, wrote a piece, sort of an editorial, and I understand both of them, Dr. Poe, you may know better, to be in favor, at least on some level, of legalization, but it gave them pause. They sort of said, you know, how do you know when you're on the slippery slope? Is 1 in 10 to 1 in 15 deaths too much? I mean, where do we stop? When do we say that the way we get rid of, expensive old people is by euthanasia? When is it too much, right? Even if you are in favor, that should give you pause. In this country, the typical refrain is that we will never become like Western Europe, that the leading organization in favor of legalization is Compassion and Choices, and it's been a part of their mission, I think, to advocate for the legalization of physician aid in dying, not euthanasia, because euthanasia takes control out of the patient's hand, in a sense, whereas aid in dying, the patient has to self-ingest. However, you know, it has been put forward in, for example, in the Oregon legislation a couple of times. There have been bills advanced to try to make euthanasia legalized there. They have not passed so far, but part of this then becomes a justice issue. So for example, if you suffer from a disability where you could not, crush the pills and mix the solution and ingest it yourself, then you need someone to help you ingest it. And so then it becomes a matter of justice. There's not just an equal access to the drugs to end one's life. So it is concerning, I think, if these bills are put forward in the US, I think there is a potential that eventually we could move from a physician-aided aid in dying to euthanasia here. And then just one other point Dr. Poe brought up, which is that when there's universal healthcare or access to healthcare, these questions are nuanced slightly differently. And I will say that there are several cases, which you can find on Google, of patients who have been told by their insurance, we won't cover your chemotherapy, but we will pay for the drugs to have physician-assisted suicide. And so these cases are kind of out there. They're very distressing to think that people cannot autonomously choose life sustaining therapy or curative treatment, but they're being told by their insurers that they can die. So that is concerning. So I think the slippery slope is a real phenomenon. It's probably a little bit slipperier in Europe than here, but it's not going to go away. And I think there's something about bringing this discussion into the open, but when it is legalized, it's going to sort of, I think, expand, as we've seen in Belgium and the Netherlands. The reasons to be able to die will increase. So that means that we will become more and more oriented toward a right to death, which, Dr. Quill's own Supreme Court cases determine that there is, in this country at least, no constitutionally protected right to death. And that was left to the determination of the states. So, yeah, I'll stop.
So thank you, Lydia. So this is the next one is a question. So it's addressed to Dr. Quill, but I guess it's really both of you could speak to this. So it's about what counts as intolerable suffering. To Dr. Quill, you said a guiding principle for hastening death should be intolerable suffering. How should we determine this? We see institutions making decisions about what they can or can't tolerate, such as Iceland's claim last year to have eradicated Down syndrome. So if you both of you might speak to this.
Yeah, I suppose intolerable suffering would be very hard to define in any black and white way, that's for sure. So it's really a situation that is unacceptable to the person. So I don't think having a requirement for overwhelming physical suffering, I think that's too high and hard a bar to have for this. So it's got to be some kind of suffering in the broadest sense of that word that they find unacceptable. And the less it's connected to immediate physical suffering and the illness itself, the more I think then you want to get, in a practical sense, you want to get psychiatry involved and ethics involved and get people to all weigh in to make sure this is really what the patient is asking about and the best way to respond under the circumstance.
Yeah, I'll just say that it's really, I mean, we always say that suffering is subjective to the one who is suffering, right? So it's hard. There's no direct measure. And when we've tried to measure pain, we've been big failures as a profession. But, you know, there was a woman who was in the newspaper a couple of years ago for going to Dignitas, this assisted dying place in Switzerland, because she'd been very beautiful in her youth and found that now in her 80s, she'd lost her beauty. And this loss of physical beauty caused her so much distress, she went and had assisted dying. And so, you know, is that intolerable suffering? Certainly the folks at Dignitas thought it was, that it met criteria. But it does raise the question of how are we going to define this? And it's very difficult to define.
Thank you, Lydia. So here's a question for both panelists from Raj Reddy, one of our Baylor medical students. Raj asks, both of you hinted at this, but what are your thoughts on the argument that the legalization of physician-assisted death and euthanasia would lead to physicians disproportionately recommending these options to patients of minorities? So Tim, we'll throw that to you.
I think it's not, I don't think that's a likely outcome at all. I think doctors are, by and large, very reluctant participants in this. There probably are some enthusiasts who are more open to a broader range of things. So in Oregon, there are a small number of doctors who do a large number of cases. And I think in California, there's a similar group. But I'm not sure that they would be, enthusiasts in the sense of soliciting people or trying to encourage people to do this. I don't know. I don't see that happening. I think it's very unlikely to happen, because it's hard to do. It's like taking somebody off of life support. It's hard to do. We can do it. you know, they're our most expensive patients. There might be coercion to try to take somebody off of life support, but we really do a good job. And when you get into, when you go into medical record, you can see why that decision was made the way it was. That's in my mind where again, these open processes are so much better than the secret processes. I want to make one other point, and that is that when you look at how often do doctors do palliative sedation to unconsciousness at the end of life, there is a huge variation between centers, ranging from infrequently, you know, 1 or 2% or 3% to 50% of deaths. Well, I will tell you, when we're doing, if the places that are doing 50% of deaths with palliative sedation, it's very close to euthanasia, but it's an acceptable form of that. So again, like other things that we do now, like palliative sedation, should also be subject to the same safeguards and documentation we're asking for some of these other more edgy possibilities.
I'll just add that I agree with Dr. Quill 100%. I think physicians are pretty reluctant to in any way suggest that we would want to give care or intentionally hasten death, especially for racial and ethnic minorities who have just been often on the, not having good access to care. So I think there's a lot of sensitivity in medicine to that, and probably even more so in the, you know, recent months, given the state of things. But interestingly, data from the Flanders region of Belgium show that between 2007 and 2013, euthanasia requests that were fulfilled doubled or tripled for the extreme elderly, for those in nursing homes, for those with little to no education, and for women. And what's interesting to me about that now, I think, I imagine they're mostly Caucasian, but what's interesting to me about that is that thinking about elderly, uneducated nursing home residents consenting to euthanasia, I have a hard time thinking that that's all voluntary. And so while this isn't a racial or ethnic minority argument, I do think vulnerable populations, there is a possibility that there will be some disproportionate hastening. But as Dr. Poole raises the point, in these centers where it's 50%, there's probably already some gray area there. So, yeah. I think we have to be careful.
Good.
We agree about that.
Yes. So here's a question from Cassie Manley. Just thank you, Dr. Quill and Dr. Dugdale, for your excellent presentations. As a hospice social worker, I see the need for fundamental systematic changes to healthcare and more broadly to our society in order to achieve a good death. For example, affordable support to families caring for the dying at home. Aside from more open conversations, what key changes do you see are needed?
Well, I think I'll throw out a few. I think hospice-like care needs to be more widely available. We have to figure out how to do that in some way that isn't going to totally break the bank, but trying to provide broader set of supports for patients and families at home, particularly those with a longer than 6-month prognosis who want a hospice philosophy of care. I think that that's a group that we clearly need to be much more creative, and insurers really ought to pretty much want to do that with us, because if we can figure out how to do that and these folks end up less in the hospital where they don't want to be in the first place, I think the economics are likely to work out. So I think being much more creative, and there have been some creative models tried across the country to broaden hospice eligibility. I think that would be one place where we could agree to work together to try to make some change that I think would be helpful. I think also just agreeing about what option, when people are really ready, how can we, when they're ready to die now and they're really tired of dying, how can we, are we allowed to educate them about options? Should we do a better job? You know, we're doing a book now on the possibility of stopping eating and drinking at the end of life. It's not the most elegant thing in the world, but it is an option that's in people's own charge. It's a little hard to do, which is a good thing in a certain way, because that's a check on making sure people are sure about it. But you know, this whole notion of our ability to prolong living, generally a really good thing, and our ability to prolong the very late stages of this just by the little treatments that we do, they're so effective, you know, like a little bit of antibiotics for somebody who would have died of pneumonia, who feels better having gotten the antibiotics, but then goes on to live another year that they were really ready to die. These are some of the challenges that our medical system really has, and we have not really fully come to grips with those kinds of things.
And I mean, it feels like there would be several fairly easy to implement stop gaps in terms of care. So the requirements for kind of having family around the clock to satisfy home hospice requirements in I would imagine many states, it puts so many demands on the family. But if we could get a caretaker in, right? If insurance could pay for a caretaker for 4 hours a day, so that a family could have respite, but then the individual could still die at home. This is not a high cost thing compared to the cost of institutionalization. Mm. Some sort of simple ways to increase care funded through insurance. And Dr. Cole made the reference to the health economics of this. Many of the ways we've been able to make advances on these in these aspects of medicine that aren't typically money generating have to do with if we can show hospital administrators how we're saving the system money, or if we can show insurers how we're saving them money, then they would be more inclined to provide resources. So showing an insurance company that giving us 4 hours a day of a home health aide so that a family could have respite is going to cost much less than every day in a hospice or a nursing home. There, you know, so it might be a way to make a difference. I think there are several things like that would be fairly easy to implement. It just needs to happen.
Good. Probably have time for just a couple of more. I'm well aware that it's one more hour on the East Coast. So this one is for Dr. Quill. As a neurologist, he says, I have seen many people die, but none of them have asked me to shorten their life. Have you had this experience? He says, most people requesting suicide in Oregon are not terminal. So if you might speak to that.
I don't know that that's true, that most people requesting this in Oregon are not terminal. Although it's, you know, I'm sure some of them are not. I just speaking to the experience of neurological illnesses, illnesses like ALS and dementia are clearly illnesses where people think a lot about this question. So ALS people are, if you look at studies of people with ALS, a lot of them want to talk about these issues. They actually probably get weak enough so that stopping eating and drinking is an option for them. Again, it's got all the same risks as assisted dying, but it is under their own control. But ALS people, patients with ALS, at least in many of the studies that I've read, is an area where there's a lot of thought being given to these kinds of questions. Similarly, people with who have dementia, who know they have dementia. If I had early dementia, I would be wondering about these options, I will promise you. Because I have no interest in personally in living into the late stages of dementia, it's just that it's not something I want to do. Now, again, I have options in this regard because I know how the system goes. But should we make options available to other people who don't know how the system goes or who don't have access? Again, I think those are questions that we should be grappling with, because I do think it's a very daunting prospect with that disease. It doesn't mean that the majority of people can't adapt, and I'm not saying at all that people don't find the late stages meaningful many, many times, but it's not for everybody.
Good. So last question here, and this is a question for both of you. How do we as future physicians address the balance between dying well and resuscitation in emergent cases like ones discussed. I noticed that the patient's or family's wishes were not mentioned, and there's a lot of legality around who you listen to. But does that mean that it's often the physician deciding whether or not, whether there's no other clear option in place? Or are we to say that a certain amount of suffering is too much for that individual? Tim, I'll throw it to you.
Well, it's not really our job to say that whatever level of suffering is too much or too little or whatever. I think it's really, we should be explorers of this with patients and families. We should go explore their experience and find out. And I have seen people who are able to live with quite well suffering that at first glance I would think would be awfully hard for me to do. But they are doing fine, and it's a small part of their being, and they can cope with it. I've also seen people who seem to be suffering overwhelmingly with what seems to be not that harsh of a situation. So again, I think we need to be students of explorers of suffering in light of the individual and their circumstance and values. And then if suffering becomes a justification for making a life and death decision, and it doesn't add up in our personal sense, then get some help. Get some help from somebody from psychiatry, somebody from social medicine, somebody from ethics, before you're really ready to do anything. And again, take assisted suicide off the table, but talk about stopping dialysis, where we all agree people have a right to do, or stopping a ventilator. These decisions are life and death decisions. And before you make a life and death decision, you really need to understand the why now and make sure you've explored it very thoroughly and that the person really wants to do that and it's well considered.
And it varies slightly by state, but in general, when it is an emergency situation, we always err on the side of life. So if we find someone down, we're going to resuscitate. And it's even so extreme in some cases that there's a patient with, you know, do not resuscitate tattooed on his chest. But because in our hospital, he didn't have I don't even remember which hospital I was at the time, so I can say it like that. He didn't have actually a form with him, and he had no one accompanying him. They did resuscitate him. So it's tricky. And in some states, they wouldn't. They would say it's pretty clear what his wishes are. He tattooed it on his chest. But in other states, they really want to be crystal clear. And so having that documentation, advanced directive, or sometimes it's a MOLST form, is really very important. But I would say overall, you know, the patient I presented, and I write about him actually extensively in the book, his daughters really, really wanted us to keep fighting. He's a fighter. This is what he would want. He's very religious. He's African American. They wanted on his behalf everything to be done because they felt that that was what he would have wanted. And so certainly, for as much as it felt bad for us knowing how sick he was, we honored their wishes because they were trying to honor his wishes. And I think generally that's the way we do things in medicine. We want very much to work with patients and their families to honor their wishes. And so if we err in one direction, it's to do everything we can to help patients stay alive. So.
Good. Well, I ask all the Zoomers to join me in a round of applause for Lydia and Tim for this great session. We really appreciate your time. And, you know, there was lots of questions we were not able to get to. So apologies for that. But alas, you know, time flies when you're having fun. For all the Zoomers out there, if you enjoyed this, I would encourage you to check out our website. There's more where this came from. So we have a lot of exciting programming coming up for the rest of the semester, as well as for the spring. So I encourage you to check that out. Lydia and Tim, thank you so much for being here with us. This has been a joy to be able to talk to you both. And I think that's all we have for tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Victor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Good to meet you, Lydia, and thank you, Victor.
Absolutely. Good night, everyone.